You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, I'm Andrew Child, and welcome to 50 Key Stage Musicals, the podcast, a companion piece to the Routledge Press publication, 50 Key Stage Musicals, which is available for purchase by going to Routledge.com or clicking the link below in today's show description. Today's episode focuses on Chapter 16, The Fantastics, and with us today is author of that chapter, David Arthur. As a long-standing member of the Lehman Engel BMI Workshop, he is the recipient of the Jerry Harrington Award. In addition to writing the book and lyrics for the New York Musical Theater Festival Award-winning About Face, with music by Jeffrey Lodin, David, along with Brian Lasser, contributed material to the Manhattan Association of Cabarets and Clubs award-winning review, Here's to Our Friends. For the concert stage, he has written for Randy Graff, Judy Kuhn, Karen Mason, Maren Mazzi, Donna Murphy, and Barbara Walsh, along with the music, lyrics, and book for Saratoga Trunk Songs. Current projects include the book and lyrics for Nobody Sleeps Well in Casablanca, with music by Douglas J. Cohen, and the book and lyrics for Oddly Enough, with music by Mary Feinsinger. David, thank you so much for being here today.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you, Andrew.
So I've read your chapter on the Fantastics, but for those listeners who maybe haven't gotten their hands on the book yet, could you maybe summarize, give us the elevator pitch, what makes the Fantastics a key musical? Why do we care?
You know what it is? It's timeless. And so many shows, they're written at a different, in a certain decade, and they own that decade. They can't really live. But the Fantastics is timeless. You can do the Fantastics 30 years from now, and it will still be effective for several elements. I mean, I think Tom and Harvey wrote an eccentric score. There are beautiful ballads in the score, but Harvey was completely unique. And when he studied music, he went to a wonderful music school, and all his teachers said, no, you can't do those chords. Those chords don't make any sense. And Harvey stuck to it. And if you listen to the score, there are so many things that are so Harvey Schmidt. And you can hear it in subsequent shows of his, in Celebration and 110 in the Shade. And even though I Do is a pretty standard musical, musically, there are still many, many times you think, oh, no one else could have written that but Harvey. And also the fact that it had a timeless story that still speaks to very young people and very old people. And it's the oldest story ever. It's just that we live within four seasons, and within those four seasons, things happen to us, and we grow, and we die in the winter, and we come back in the spring, and we're off to the races again, and we've learned something. And I think that's the greatest message to people who see it. It's not dated. They very wisely didn't put it in any specific period. If you look at the show now, let's say it's already 60 years old. You can look at it and think, well, was this written last year? Because even the way that they treat the costuming, and the whole show has a timeless element. You can't figure out what decade it's really in, and that helps the show as well.
So yeah, it totally seems like these very strange, almost discordant sounds that keeps it very timeless. Would you say that from a lyrical standpoint, are there also moments in this show that you feel like you could pinpoint as making this seem more contemporary, making this seem sort of ahead of its time?
I think Tom went out of his way to make sure that it has poetry. The lyrics are all poetic. And they don't, in other words, within the lyrics, they're not talking about New York City or something. Uh-huh. We're obviously in a rural section of the country. And none of the lyrics are wedded to anything that's current. They're all timeless. The same way, say, for instance, in the movie of The Wizard of Oz, there was a song written, a dance number, called The Jitterbug. And it was, this is 1939. And Harold Arlen's score, again, was very eccentric and beautiful in that movie, also containing one of the most beautiful ballads ever written.
Right.
But when they were doing the final cuts on the movie, they decided to throw out The Jitterbug because it was a jitterbug in a very 1940s kind of number. And they were afraid it would age the show, that you would not be able to think of it as being timeless. A very wise decision.
Oh, absolutely. Do you think in a similar way, do you think when they're in the room there with the piano, they're working on the Fantastics, is that same sort of cutting process happening? Are they actively trying to create something that can be timeless? Or do you think that's something that just they stumbled upon?
I think they were very aware of it. These are two excellent writers. Harvey's no longer with us, but Tom is still active. He's 95 years old, I think, now. Wow. And he is still working. He's writing the music for a musical adaptation of Harold and Maude.
Oh, cool. Love that movie.
Very cool. And also, Tom is unafraid of rewriting, completely throwing out a song. His collaborator, the composer, the excellent Joseph Falcon, keeps writing. I mean, he keeps handing him lyrics, and Joe keeps writing new songs for the show. But the same thing was true when they did 110 in the Shade. I think they must have, for a show that probably contains 18 songs, they probably ultimately wrote 80 songs.
Wow.
So it's like in a in a poem or in a lyric, because I write lyrics, and there's only one right word, and you search for it. And you, because there's great economy with writing lyrics, so every word counts. Every word has got to mean something. And Tom, being an excellent lyricist, and Tom also did the book. I think Ward Baker also worked on the book for the Fantastics. It was, and it's very, there's a lot of humor in it, and a lot of broad humor.
Oh, absolutely.
But it all somehow works in a very kind of avant-garde, commedia dell'arte way that never seems like they're jumping off a cliff. It all seems, again, very 1960s avant-garde, because that's the way those shows were written and they were embraced. But shows are still being written like that. And I, for one, love to go see a show that the authors take a chance. They jump in with both feet. Because if it's too predictable or you're sort of ahead of it, then it becomes a little bit of a chore to get through it. There are many shows now. Flying Over Sunset was one that recently opened that I saw. And again, I admired it for taking tremendous chances and at every turn jumping in with two feet. There's another one, an opera playing at the Mitzi Newhouse that does exactly the same thing that Jason Robert Brown wrote. Again, very courageous. And I think you have to. I think you have to, instead of writing what's popular today, this very second, you have to somehow magically look in the future and figure out a way to make a difference, and a different way of musical. And I think that's what Tom and Harvey did with the Fantastics.
Well, I think there are so many, just you mentioned these discordant chord progressions early on that he was writing.
Yes.
And there are so many that spring to mind in the Fantastics that seem so distinctive, so beautiful. My favorite is in Soon It's Gonna Rain, the Where We Can Stay is maybe one of my favorite just sounds in all of musical theater. So it really is amazing that they could put notes together in such a unique way that we still don't really hear replicated, and that is sort of out of nowhere in time.
Well, I agree. And also, just look, even at the verse of Soon It's Going to Rain is so brilliantly written and musically and harmonically eccentric. You hear things like, even how it starts out so beautiful. See how the wind begins to whistle. See how the stream. And that is gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And then Harvey sticks in, ba-da-da-da. Oh, goodness. Where did that come from? And yet it makes perfect sense. There's always something dissonant, which is foreshadowing of the rain.
Mm.
In other words, soon it's going to rain, but not right now. You know, so mm-hmm. and if it does, we'll be okay. But there's a lot of dissonance in that beautiful score, that beautiful tune.
Oh, absolutely.
So, and much it happens.
It calls to mind another one that I really love that you sort of talked about, 110 in the Shade.
Yes.
I love when he keeps coming back to that name, Melisande, in the song.
Yes.
I love the way that builds. It's that same sort of, what are these notes? We've never put these together.
Melisande,
like
you know.
Yeah.
And it's, that is, he didn't write Melisande.
Exactly.
Melisande. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. And I love 110 in the Shade. Are you a fan of that show as well?
You know, I'm very familiar with it because I saw as a kid, I was in school, and it was a bus and truck that came into Chicago.
Okay.
And played the Schubert Theater, which was a big roadhouse in Chicago. Mm. But it was obviously a bus and truck, and it was only coming in for, I think, 2 weeks or something. Maybe a booking got canceled or something. And the look of it kind of looked like a bus and truck. It was all backdrops, and some of them were ripped on the side.
Mm.
And stuff. But it was Jeanne Crain and Biff McGuire. And I just fell in love with it.
With that show?
I didn't know the score. Yes, because my principal of my high school called and offered anyone who wants to see 110. And I went to an all-boys high school, by the way.
Okay.
But anyone who wants to go to see 110 in the Shade, we have little vouchers that you can present at the box office, and you can see it for $2.
Wow.
Four of my friends, we got on the 63rd Street bus and went downtown, and we sat in the second balcony of the Schubert Theater. I think then it was still called the second balcony. Now it's the rear mezzanine.
Hmm.
And I was, because the show opens really quietly. You hear, ba-da-da, la-da-da, ba-dum, weird chord there from Harvey.
Mm.
And I was already with them.
Okay.
And yeah, it was just great. And then it opens slowly. There's a number called It's Gonna Be Another Hot Day.
Mm.
And not the way, a typical way a musical would open.
No.
You could see how hot they were and what they were doing. And also later, because I love the musical so much, and I bought the album.
Mm-hmm.
And then so I went to go see the source material on a movie that Katharine Hepburn and Burt Lancaster did called The Rainmaker.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised and delighted that many, many of Tom's lyrics were taken straight from the text.
Oh, wow.
So Lizzie's Old Maid was almost word for word what N. Richard Nash wrote in the,
in the
original.
Oh, wow. That's really... 110 in the Shade is also very significant for me, slightly less romantic, but one of my earliest memories of seeing anything theater related and being like, whoa, we can do this, was staying up late. And my mother let us stay up late to watch the first part of the Tony Awards. And it was the year that the Roundabout had done one tent. So Audra McDonald performed Raunchy, she's up on a table and she's doing cartwheels. And I don't think that we stayed up late enough to watch any of the big like ensemble show-stopping numbers, but that just, that was crazy. So of course I also had to get my hands on like, what is 110 in the Shade? Give me more. I need more. And here I am.
Well, the original production had Robert Horton and Inga Swenson. Mm. And that recording is just so brilliant.
Mm.
And he had never done a musical before, but he's a fine baritone voice. And she was out of this world. Mm. The end of the first act is Old Maid. Mm-hmm. And which is it's a searing number. And then I remember, even as a kid, I was blown away that the set or the lighting plot, as it went on, it got redder and redder and redder and redder. So at the very end, when she's kind of like flipping out, the whole stage is red. The backdrop is red.
Oh, wow.
And you can see how she's just flipping out, realizing that she's never going to get married, that she'll never be happy. She'll never have children. She'll be wind up taking care of her father and her brothers until they all die or get married. So it's an incredible first act closing. So you haven't ever listened to the original Robert Horton, Inga Swenson recording of Unintended the Shade, treat yourself.
I second that. Anyone who hasn't listened, I absolutely love that album. I love this score. I'd love to know, do you think should young lyricists, young composers who want to be working in musical theater, should they be paying special attention to shows like The Fantastics, shows like 110 in the Shade?
Well, I think they should. I think they should listen to them. I think they should study them and then forget them and then write what they want to write. But it'll teach them the basics. And also, there's nothing wrong with studying something that works. You know, there are plenty of crappy musicals.
Right.
That I would say, well, don't listen to those. You're not going to learn anything. But learn from the pros. You know, go back, listen to Rodgers and Hammerstein, George Gershwin, Ira Gershwin. Listen to them. Don't ape them. But realize that these men and women who wrote these shows were on top of their game. And I still listen to things like from what they wrote. And sometimes I'll even, after I've heard something, especially things from when I was younger, that kind of just went over my head, you know, and I'm just used to hearing them.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. And now I hear them, I thought, oh my God, that's what that means. Oh, yes. So you can always learn something from these great writers. And again, to answer your question, yes, I would say these things should be studied. Lehman Engel, who started the BMI workshop, was insistent that the young writers be versed in the classics. And then later on, there were other people who took over the workshop, like Maury Yeston and Richard Inquist. And it was the same thing. I mean, they would make a point of bringing material into the workshop and having the class hear and see how they did it. How they waited until the end of they didn't give it away in the first part of the lyric of the line. So a lot of times writers will run to that rhyme at the end. Well, it's actually everything that winds up before the rhyme is the real meat of it and what we should be paying attention to, and not the rhyme.
Do you go with that mentality when you start approaching writing the lyrics for a musical?
I do. I follow what a lot of the really wonderful lyricists have already written, and I've learned from them, and I try to apply it in my own lyrics. And that always every song is a three-act play. You have to look at it as a three-act play. We don't start at the very beginning. You know, you have to dole it out so that you have a premise, you have a middle section, which would be, say, your second act, and the end, which is a summation. And at the end of the lyric, you either that singer or the lyric has had a change in it, or sometimes it's as simple as, like in a Sondheim lyric, sometimes he'll consider a lot of things in the lyric and then realize at the end, you know what, I don't even know if that's the, you know, I don't know. I'm still oblivious as to what I should do. But the actor and the writer of the lyric has gone through the journey. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Do you think, are there songs in the whole musical theater canon that come to mind for you when you talk about a song being a three-act play that you think?
Oh man! Well, they nailed, you know, that? The classic one is Billy's Soliloquy in Carousel.
Oh, of course. Okay.
Okay, so he goes through many changes in that soliloquy. I mean, at first he'll think he's kind of pompous, you know. He'll call me the old man. He'll be good. So, and then later on, you know, he realizes, oh my God, what if he is a she? What if it's a girl? And then he changes everything, the whole world changes. And then he has that beautiful snippet of my little girl, pink and white as peaches. Oh my God. And then the final summation is that he makes that the willful decision. She's going to be comforted and fed and dressed in the best that money can buy. I never knew how to make money, but I'll try. God damn it, I'll try. You know, and he'll do that or die. That's how he ends that soliloquy. And that is a huge journey. Now, not all songs have to make that dramatic of a journey.
I mean, I was going to say that also, that's like a 10-minute song in and of itself. You know, that's.
Yes, it is.
Some heft. Wow.
Yeah. Well, Sondheim was a genius at even shorter numbers, like Little Red's number in Into the Woods.
Okay.
Called I Know Things Now, you know, that I never have known. You know, that, and then you get how she was afraid and scared. And then at the very end, it's like, isn't it nice to know a lot and a little bit not? So it's good to know a lot, but Sondheim, being such a genius, said, yeah, it's, you know, he said, good to know all of that, but also not so fast. There's, yeah. So he was always, there was a lot to think about in his lyrics and still will be forever.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Do you approach, when you are writing music for cabarets, for the concert stage, do you come in with the same mentality as when you're writing pieces for a musical theater piece?
I do. I just think they're more interesting.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I just think so. I think that it engages an audience because sometimes if the lyric doesn't travel, it's what I would call traveling. They'll zone out. You know, they just get complacent to the listening to what might be a very beautiful melody, but they're not engaged with the text. And because I did write a lot of cabaret songs for people, and they were all, the singers are all brilliant. And
I was going to say, for people, you've written a lot for some huge people, some very big names.
Yeah. So a lot of times I was asked to write something for a concert, and they said, we would like you to write for, say, Randy Graff. Mm-hmm. So I would call Randy, and I got to know her very well, and she did the lead in one of my musicals and was fantastic. But at the time, I didn't know her that well. And I said, well, what do you like to sing? I mean, what kind of number would you like to do for this evening? Because they're the one that's going to be up there doing it.
Right.
So she's brilliant at comedy. So I wrote her a comedy number.
Mm.
And she's very, very smart about comedy. Mm-hmm. And what I learned from Randy is that the tempo is in a comedy number is everything. So if you go too fast on the tempo, they won't get the jokes.
Mm-hmm.
You'll speed through the text and they won't get the jokes. Mm-hmm. If you go too slow, then they're ahead of you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if that makes any sense.
No, absolutely.
So, and again, this was a real story song. The name of the song is A Good Book.
Hmm.
And it's about a woman telling us how her early part of her life was spent dating the wrong men. Okay. So a lot of times she would go out, and if she was not having a very good time. So she, in order for her to have a good time, along with going to the movie, she would bring a good book.
Okay.
So if she gets, yeah. So in case if things weren't going well, she would open up a book and start reading.
Oh, nice.
which is, again, for a comedy number, what you try to do is not, any kind of song. You don't hit it on the nose. It's what I call taking the side door. You find another way to say it differently. That's a surprise for the audience.
So let's come back, I guess, a little bit back to the Fantastics. Do you think that it's one of those shows that we sort of have the shows before the Fantastics, but then once the Fantastics is on the scene, do we see sort of an artistic influence from this show in the following musical theater works that come after it?
Yeah, I think so, definitely, particularly off-Broadway.
Okay.
Because Broadway was still used to doing huge musicals with big casts.
Mm.
And there was a musical called The Golden Apple that was done off-Broadway originally, scaled down, but it was in essence a big musical. And it was very beautifully written in the same way. It was very eccentric musically. And at that time, everyone was encouraged to write stuff that was different. And even the off-Broadway shows that opened after the Fantastics and to this day have a tendency to be quirky. So you would on occasion get something like You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, but that's an anomaly.
Okay.
But off-Broadway, you were encouraged to be, there's a phrase that carpenters use, which is a couple bubbles of plum. Do you know what that means?
I do not know what that means.
Okay, this is good. My father taught me this. He was a brilliant carpenter.
Perfect.
And it's a level that you put against the wall, and there's a little thing in the middle of it. So if it's a little bit off, the bubble will be off the center.
Uh-huh.
But the bubble has to be absolutely in the center of these two lines. And if it's a couple bubbles off plum, it's eccentric. It's a little off.
Okay.
So off-Broadway things were encouraged to be a couple bubbles off plum.
Got it. Okay.
Okay.
Do you think, are there other off-Broadway musicals that you would say are a couple bubbles off plum that you think musical theater writers, lyricists, composers should be paying attention to today?
Well, there were a lot of them. A lot of them weren't very successful, like The Adding Machine was very eccentric. But I admired it, again, because it jumped in with both feet. They're a Little Shop of Horrors. We all kind of think, oh, yeah, with that's, oh, when that first opened, that was really that score, that driving, the Howard Ashman lyrics. And it was written like a real musical, but none of it was like a real musical.
It's silly. It's just a couple bubbles off Plum, but yes. It's wild.
Well, when the plant started singing and eating people, we knew that there was something odd going on. Yeah.
And do you think, can we trace back the ability for Little Shop of Horrors to become the huge success it is today? Does it owe anything to the Fantastics, you think?
I think everything owes something to the Fantastics. I think that it put on all the green lights for anyone who wanted to write something and had something in their heart that was unusual. And again, Tom's lyrics are so beautiful and so poetic and exciting and funny. And Harvey's work, song for song, is exceptional. When they finally get to Round and Round in the second act, which is so macabre, it's almost theater of the, you know, bizarre, macabre. And just all of those, again, the weird chord progressions. And also the fact that the show opens with an eccentric little overture that has nothing to do with anything else in the show. You never hear that tune again. You know, and it's that was unusual. So I think that maybe it could be that Harvey liked the fact that the overture to Candide was a tune that really wasn't used anywhere else in the show. And in that overture, we get "Oh happy pair, oh happy we," but the rest of it is an eccentric original Leonard Bernstein piece that's often played in concert halls.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a fabulous piece. And
oh, it is.
It absolutely, it riles you up to watch a musical comedy. I've been at multiple concerts and seen it played. And I think it's a letdown to follow that up with...
with the show?
No, with some other song. I want to see...
Oh, I know. I
want to see Candide now, you know? Keep going. Yeah. Bring him out.
Well, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful overture. And I hear it all the time on WQXR here in New York. And it's always like you're hearing it for the first time. There's so many colors in it. And you can see Leonard Bernstein's brilliance. And also the great talent he had for beautiful melodic song, like the verse to "Oh happy pair, oh happy we." La da 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 ba da 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 da. It's just lush and beautiful. So I mean, I turn into a puddle when I hear a great overture like that.
That's another score. That's another show. I mean, you are aptly calling it also eccentric, but then the lyrics to the part that you were just singing are also so lush, like you said. They're so tied in with nature. They're so disjointed from any particular place, from any time. They're just plain beautiful.
Yeah. You know why? Because with every score, if you only had eccentric, if you only had things that were jagged, you would start getting annoyed listening to it. So that's why even in the songs in the Fantastics, when the couple at the end sing "They Were You," the tune is so simple and the lyric is so simple. When the moon was young, when the month was May, when the stage was hung for our holiday, I saw shining lights, but I never knew they were you. Well, that's a very direct from the heart lyric, and the tune is as simple as well. Did you know that that was Gower Champion's favorite song?
Oh, really?
Yeah, of all the songs he ever heard, and he heard a lot, he thought that that was the loveliest song he had ever heard for the stage.
It absolutely is an incredible song. I mean, it's so hard to talk about the Fantastics just because they're every song that we're going to mention, I'm going to say, oh, that's my favorite song in this show. Well, I love that song.
Yeah. Well, you know what it is? Because you get something from every drawer in the bureau. So you get something silly from the Fathers. You get two vaudeville numbers from the mm-hmm. Fathers, which are very welcome, one in the first act, one in the second. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you get the eccentric characters of the Indian and the old actor climbing out of a trunk, which is way, way crazy. And then sexy El Gallo comes out and sings, It All Depends on What You Pay. Mm-hmm. And you see the end of the world weariness and knowledge of El Gallo and the complete naivete of Matt and Louisa. And the tone of all the songs are different. So you get I Can See It, which is very rhythmic, jazzy song about going out and doing it, getting out. I want to go out and experience all this. Mm. And Louisa has a similar moment when she's El Gallo is after her necklace and makes the world that she's about to see, and then she does see it, and it's not so pretty. Mm. You know, what he sets before her, she's ready for a beautiful, lovely, lyrical, waltzy time, and it all turns sour. Every one of the episodes of her going out into the world, same thing for the boy. And that's the other thing that makes it so beautiful, is that at the end, they both went out. It's a little bit like, you know, there's no place like home, mm-hmm. but they went out and they experienced something, and they realized at the end of that, what they really wanted was each other. They saw it, they experienced it, it wasn't pretty. Mm-hmm. So I mean, I'm sure there are instances where people go out and it's very pretty and they're very satisfied they did it. But for the Fantastics, it's really a great story. And that's why, again, I think that it's timeless, and it's something that anyone could see and they'll realize something from it from their youth, or at some time as they were getting older, how they felt about looking at the world, how their attitudes have changed. And of course, the narrator has seen it all.
Would you say that you have a particular version of this show, whether it's an album or the movie, that if we have listeners who aren't familiar with the show, that would be a good introduction to the Fantastics, that would help them?
You know, with the movie of the Fantastics that they did was very earnest, but I'm not criticizing it, because it was a tough piece to put on film.
Oh, absolutely.
But it fails in every department.
Okay.
So I would not recommend that any young person wanting to study the Fantastics looks at the film, because that's really not the show. A lot of the tunes are, and I think even Tom and Harvey wrote something special for the movie. But I would say listen to the original cast album. There may be, and also, you know, most local productions, the show's been done so much that it pretty much, no one really messes around with it too much, because you know what I mean?
I think
so. Whatever you see, you're going to, that's going to pretty much be. And the other wonderful thing is that it's live, seeing the Fantastics live. But definitely a good start to it is to get a hold of that MGM original off-Broadway cast, where you get Rita Gardner and Jerry Orbach and Kenneth Nelson and all these brilliant actors and singers. And also just the beauty of that harp and the piano. You know, I mean, it's perfect. And, you know, they had a lot of choices when they were, because they were on a very limited budget. And they chose the harp as opposed to a percussion, a set of drums or something. But that was a very wise choice.
Oh, absolutely. Have you seen it done several times?
Many times, I'll be honest with you. I saw it the first time when I was 16 years old, and it was done in my high school. Well, not my high school. It was done at an all-girls high school. And they, obviously they were going to cast Louisa as a girl, but they also cast the fathers as mothers to get two more girls in the show.
Oh, good.
So, and then the boy came from another high school, and I came from an all boys high school, St. Lawrence High School. And it was wonderful. I think I was probably the worst El Gallo that has ever walked on the stage. I was so hell-bent to be sexy.
Okay.
And there was nothing sexy about a skinny 16-year-old trying to be sexy.
Well, it's hard because Jerry Orbach is so sexy. Like, you can listen to his voice and you just know it's exuding sensuality. So that's a high bar if you were familiar with the recording at that point.
No. And that was a tough thing for a 16-year-old kid to do. Until this day, there's a short video of it. And I look at it and I'm so embarrassed about it. I've got this little black cape and the stupid black hat on and, just trying to strut around. It was vomit provoking. I'm telling you.
Oh, God. And that's when you said, I'm going to write lyrics.
I think I'm going to do, but I worked as an actor for many, many years, but I never did the Fantastics again, but I saw it many times. Mm. I actually saw Richard Chamberlain play El Gallo in a production in Chicago. He was very, very good. And there was a road company that went out that played in Chicago. Again, very excellent.
Mm.
But you can find excellent productions of the Fantastics being done. I have a friend who did it recently in Northbrook, Illinois, and he loved directing it.
Mm.
And he said many times when he would call me and say, "You know what? This thing is so rich.
Mm.
It plays so beautifully, and there's so much humor and heartache in it. And it's done with a very small amount of people and a piano and a harp."
Well, and
the other thing. Go ahead. I was going to say that the end of the overture, Baker, who directed it, knew that at the very end. The overture was wiping up, and at that time, off-Broadway overtures were always very grounded. we're getting to the end of that. And at the end, the mute grabs in his bag and throws up like 150 paper squares, like tissue paper squares in every conceivable color that you can imagine. So that last flurry before the overture ended was this 150 of these things floating down to the stage.
Wow.
Yeah.
So there we go. It's so simple. It doesn't take $1 million. It doesn't take a huge technical knowledge, but it's magical. It's alive. I was going to say, when you're talking about how few people it takes to pull it off, I think we're going to see a golden age of amateur groups and smaller theaters presenting the Fantastics, just because with the restrictions on gathering right now, it's a pared down company. My younger brother, I think as we're recording this, I think next week is in an amateur production in Duxbury, Massachusetts. But talking to him after he's playing Matt, and after the first rehearsal, he was so taken aback by, you know, the two actors who are playing the fathers. I think this is each of their third time doing the role, and there are other people in the show with him who, I did Matt, but now I'm doing the older actor, you know, all these different this legacy of this show, that beyond being this artistic bar that we can reach to, it also just has such a huge life and is so significant to so many people who are working in theater, or so many people who love theater. And I think it hits on everything that you've touched upon, that it's eccentric, it's a little strange, it's lush, it's beautiful. It was ahead of its time, that it all just kind of comes together to make this beautiful little magical show.
Well, Andrew, I'll be very honest. I've seen it maybe a dozen times. Over the years, I've listened to it a dozen times. I've heard people sing songs from it.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I see it, I well up at the end. And when they're taking the sweater that Matt is wearing, and it's the fall, you know, it's it's cold. And then he wraps the sweater around himself and her. And she says, both, there's room for both. Mm. And I just, and then they sing that beautiful song. And the other thing is that the significance of the last line of the show. Mm-hmm. And the fathers come out and they say, oh, let's tear down the wall. And El Gallo says, no, leave the wall. You must always leave the wall. And for years, I couldn't figure out that last line. Mm-hmm. Until eventually I talked to Tom about it. And he said, oh, there's always has to be a barrier. That if you just all let all of the walls down, there's no conflict. And all lives need conflict. So there always needs to be something that you have to get through. And it makes you stronger. And it makes the relationship that you have with that other person stronger. Mm. So that's what that line means. There wow. must you must always leave the wall. I know it sounds a little cold, but it isn't. Ask any married couple that have been married for 50 years. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of ups and downs, and there are things that happen in that relationship that after they get through them, it makes that relationship stronger. I had a couple, I went to their 50th wedding anniversary recently, and they were talking in front of the entire group that was there for their wedding. And my friend Phyllis said, someone recently asked me, what's it like being married 50 years? And she said, it's like being married 50 years, which is very funny, but it sort of goes into what I'm saying about you have this, you have that, this is done, this happens. That. So it's this little balance that you're always trying to make. And I think that's what that line at the end of the Fantastics means. There always needs to be something that will get in the way, and then you find a way to get past it.
And it goes back to what you were talking about earlier, speaking about lyrics, that sometimes there is something that you haven't experienced, that you don't recognize, that you come to, and it doesn't really mean anything. It goes over your head. But that is one of those lines that later in life you can kind of come back to, or at different points in your life you can come back to, and it will have significance. It will mean something different. You'll understand it differently, which I think... Yes. makes it such a great ending to this strange little play.
Yeah. Well, there's wisdom in all of it. Even in the naivete of the two kids. Mm. I mean, they're comical because they are so naive. And also anybody over a certain age will be aware that, right. And it's almost comical because, an audience member with a few years on them will realize, oh my God, I was just like that. Could I ever been that silly? Oh my, was I? And then the answer resoundingly is always, yes, you were that silly. But you deserve to do that because your own, at the beginning, she says, I'm 15 years old and every day something wonderful happens to me. Mm. And she says, please God, please don't let me be normal. Mm. So she wants something exciting and something more thrilling than what she's currently experiencing in her life. And the boy is just ridiculous. I mean, in the beginning, you know, he's going to fight battles and do all of these things. And you think, oh, come on, you know, but you realize that's what you do when you're younger, because you're intrepid and you think everything is possible and you're going to change everything. And they're sweet and you don't dislike them for a moment because we see ourselves in them. We get it.
Well, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Oh, you know what? You're terrific. And thanks. I hope I didn't talk too much.
No, absolutely not. And thank you to our listeners for being with us. Please make sure to purchase a copy of 50 Key Stage Musicals by visiting Routledge.com or by clicking in today's show description. If you want to learn more about the Fantastics, please also review the links in the below description. I'm Andrew Child, and thank you for listening to 50 Key Stage Musicals, the podcast.
Try to remember the kind of September when life was slow and oh, so mellow. Try to remember the kind of September when grass was green.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard. So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.